Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kudelska.
And I'm Nikki Ouellette. The Rock Springs Resource Management Plan is getting updated again.
A lot of people just weren't clear on what land use plan is even currently in place. It's been such a long, confusing process.
Between the government shutdown and rising prices, a lot of folks are worried about groceries. We go behind the scenes of a food distribution.
This really helps out a lot because food brings people together, and that's what it's about, family and community.
And we take a look at a rural clinical program in Thermopolis that some say is helping the state's physician workforce shortage.
I want to be just like the docs that are here in Thermopolis that are doing it all. They're in the clinics, they're in the ER, they're in the hospital.
All that and more coming up on Open Spaces.
Want to keep up with local news but can't have your radio on 24/7? That's where Wyoming Public Radio's email newsletters come in. Get all of the local and regional news you want in your inbox. You can choose if you want an update every day or a weekly roundup of our top stories, or both. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kudelska.
And I'm Nikki Ouellette. The Bureau of Land Management is revising its current plan for managing 3 million acres in southwest Wyoming. This amendment comes just a year after the agency adopted the current plan, which is still causing a lot of anger and confusion here in the Equality State. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan attended an open house where BLM staff were on hand to explain where things stand and where they're headed. Caitlin set the scene.
So this is the Rock Springs Resource Management Plan, and as many of us might remember, it was adopted last year and was in development for over a decade. But now the Trump administration is calling for amendments based on Trump's Unleashing American Energy executive order. So we don't know a lot about what could be amended, but based on that executive order, it gives us some hints, like prioritizing energy development and rescinding climate change conservation measures. And I should note, we are in the second stage of a 10-step NEPA process, National Environmental Policy Act. So we're in the very beginning here.
So early days. And you've reported on this a lot. What's in place now is what the BLM advertised as trying to strike a balance between wildlife conservation and energy development. Leading up to that decision, there was a lot of tension. For a moment, it seemed like the BLM was going to go with a much more conservation-oriented plan. And I remember that caused a lot of anger.
Yeah, that was back in summer of 2023, and it was super contentious, largely because this area is home to some of Wyoming's biggest natural gas fields, which kind of makes that the economic backbone for a lot of the communities. But then it's also home to pristine wildlife habitat. It supports the world's longest known mule deer migration route, largest pronghorn herd, and the most condensed area of sage grouse. Ultimately, the conservation-oriented plan was kicked out, and that isn't what's in place today. But it is still causing a lot of heartburn, which I'll get into later.
Noted. Okay, so bring us back to this meeting at the Sweetwater Events Complex.
There was a bunch of different BLM personnel, and it kind of looked like a high school science fair. Different people posted up by different poster boards explaining different parts of the current Resource Management Plan, or RMP. And then there was lots of members of the public who came through, I would say several dozen, milling about, asking questions.
What was the general vibe?
A lot of confusion, and I would say even edging into anger at times. There were quite a few local politicians that were there, and a lot of people just weren't clear on what land use plan is even currently in place. It's been such a long, confusing process, and the document itself is hundreds and hundreds of pages long. A lot of people who I talked to, it seemed like what they're mad about is what was in that conservation-oriented draft. Once again, that isn't what was adopted. But I want to play you some of what I heard from the attendees and their concerns, and then how a BLM representative responded.
Sounds great.
Okay, up first is Jerry Gillen. He's a lifelong Rock Springs resident who's worked in oil and gas. He was there with his wife, Donna. Gillen wants to see changes because he thinks the current plan restricts road and trail access.
Aspen Mountain outside of town, that's been our playground since I was a kid. And there's actually people going up there getting on our state roads being arrested.
Really?
Yes.
That was right after.
Yeah, the RMP came out last time. There were people getting tickets, threatened with being arrested.
So I brought that concern to BLM's Kimberly Foster.
No, not that if they got a ticket, it may be in something, you know, unrelated to the RMP for some other something, but there's nothing in the RMP that would require that.
Foster added that the RMP, or resource management plan, that's in place right now, it created two new areas where recreation is the top management priority. And then while I was there, I also bumped into Senator Stacey Jones. She represents Rock Springs in the Wyoming legislature. She's also worried about restrictions for recreation, but also business.
For our Trona mines to expand, which is most of the people in Sweetwater County are employed by our Trona mines. So it's a huge deal.
In response, BLM's Foster says that for the area that's known to have Trona resources.
Yeah, there were no restrictions to Trona.
So no restrictions on Trona. What about oil, gas, coal?
Yeah, so there were several Sweetwater County commissioners there who were really worried about energy development access under the current plan. I asked Commissioner Rob Slaughter if he could point to some specifics.
I know that they really cut back the amount that was available for coal. As a comparison between what we had previously on oil and gas, I'm not sure.
So the current plan keeps a little over 70% of the area open to oil and gas leasing. That's about 2.5 million acres. Foster says acreage-wise, that's pretty much the same to what was open to oil and gas in decades past. And as for coal, technically two bigger areas were closed in the plan to coal mining, the Southern Wind River Range and Little Mountain, but
both of those areas fall outside of that coal occurrence and development area, which means it's unlikely there's probably coal there, but it's unlikely to be mineable.
The real gorilla in the room, though, Nikki, are these special management areas that are totally off limits to energy development. They're called ACECs, or Areas of Critical Environmental Concern. There's just shy of 1 million acres that are ACECs in the plan that was adopted last year, so about a quarter of the field office. And that's where a lot of the energy development restrictions exist. Before the current plan was adopted, Governor Mark Gordon and the Sweetwater County Commissioners asked for the ACECs to be downsized, and that didn't happen as much as they wanted. Commissioner Chair Keaton West told me he doesn't think the data supports protecting all these areas.
It feels as more of a lock to keep out development rather than an actual purpose and need.
But conservation groups widely dispute that. They say the wildlife habitat and migration routes are some of the best studied, and the data points to needing protections. Tom Christensen, a former game and fish biologist, spoke about the Golden Triangle, which is the Southern Wind River Range area that's currently protected under an ACEC.
Largest sage-grouse population on the planet, the mule deer and pronghorn migration corridor, an unfed elk herd of over 1,000 that all are essentially on top of each other. And it's no coincidence, it's because of that undeveloped landscape.
Now this one has been pretty confusing, especially lately. Some of the Golden Triangle area was included in a recent list of zones that might be leased for oil and gas next year. I asked BLM Acting State Director Chris Kirby specifically.
We have taken a look at those, and I believe we're coming out December 17th with the next piece of public information on that, and it will show, I think, that those parcels are no longer being scoped.
So where do things go from here?
Yeah, I mean, we're, again, so early into this process, and the BLM hasn't put any specific changes on the table yet. That'll actually happen sometime this spring when the agency releases a draft amendment. The public will get to comment again, and in theory, the whole process should be wrapped up by October 2nd of next year.
And this project is not being fast-tracked like some others are. Keatlin, thanks so much for sharing your reporting.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The This fall, the Department of Health traveled all over the state to hear what Wyomingites see as the top priorities for healthcare. The department wanted to find out about challenges it should try to address in the state's application for a big chunk of federal money to help with rural healthcare delivery. A top priority? Addressing the healthcare workforce shortage, partly by creating more hands-on clinical experiences in rural areas.
Those programs work.
Tracy Haas is the state's Medicaid medical director.
People stay in either the community they trained or nearby. And so the more we can get a geographic diversity, a bigger footprint in our state, the better.
So Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kadelska went to Thermopolis to see one training program the state wants to expand on.
Just looking at her x-ray here, was there any additional workup done in the emergency room that kind of pushed the team in the direction of thinking croup?
She had been diagnosed with croup a month prior and kind of treated.
Dr. Mattson Mathy and Celeste Keelan huddle around a laptop in an examination room. Mathy is asking Keelan about the patient she saw this morning.
And then can you think of the classic pathogen that precipitates croup?
Is that Haemophilus?
Parainfluenza.
Parainfluenza.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mathy is a family physician at Hot Springs Health. Keelan is a med school student. This is her third rotation at the Thermopolis Hospital.
When I spent 4 weeks here over the summer, I was doing sutures, I was helping with deliveries, I was helping cauterize the nose, very hands-on, very in on the action.
These clinical experiences are usually reserved for the later years of med school, but Keelan is just in her second. Mathy says they throw students right into the thick of things. Many med programs are more of a shadowing experience.
And here, if a student is with an attending for the day and we have a lesion removal, they're going to be doing the numbing injection. They're going to be performing part of the biopsy.
That's because Keelan is a WAMI student. WAMI is a multi-state medical program based at the University of Washington. Wyoming joined in 1997. Wyomingites who get into the program have an incentive to return to the state once they graduate. If they work here for 3 years, Wyoming will pay almost the entirety of their tuition.
Two out of every three students who graduates come back into practice in Wyoming.
That's Dr. Todd Guth. He's Wyoming's WAMI director. He says 10 years ago, they started a program called TRUST, Targeted Rural Undeserved Track.
Those are all rural-focused experiences where students get to spend extended periods of time in rural clinic spaces. And they're not just bouncing around, they're staying there.
Goof says the hands-on clinical experience in rural Wyoming has helped increase the retention rate.
Students want to come back and work in Wyoming because they've had those experiences within the state and part of their education is in the state. And we think that's really powerful to kind of motivate people to come back.
The program relies on state funds to help pay for about 3/4 of students' overall tuition, but tuition costs increase a bit every year, and state funds to make up the difference can lag. Guth also says the number of applicants has been decreasing. Thermopolis is one of the TRUST locations. Keelan is in that program. Before this morning, she had only read about croup, that case she reviewed with Mathy, in a textbook.
So it was just really nice to see that. Well, nice for me, but poor for the little girl. But it was just really nice to see that brought to life and actually have a real world example to kind of tie that to. So that way I won't necessarily mistake it going forward. It just kind of cements that information in my brain.
Keelan's from Rock Springs. She wants to be a family physician in Wyoming.
I want to be just like the docs that are here in Thermopolis that are doing it all. They're in the clinics, they're in the ER, they're in the hospital. They're really just this great team that's working so hard to meet the needs of the community that they love and live in.
In fact, Mathy's education is very similar to Keelan's. He's from Green River, and he says if WAMI didn't exist...
Yeah, I don't know that I ever would have strongly considered medicine without that, particular options being available to me to explore.
Mathy and Keelan's experience might become more common if the state wins those federal dollars to transform rural healthcare. Part of the plan is to partner with more hospitals around the state to create more hands-on clinical programs and create awards to cover the cost of medical school. The health department will find out early next year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska in Thermopolis.
Up next, we head behind the scenes at a food distribution as the holidays and cold weather arrive. This is Open Spaces.
This time on The Modern West, we meet a house builder who doesn't have a house of his own. Instead, he lives in an RV on the edge of Wyoming's Big Hollow. It's not for the faint of heart.
I wrote some stuff out in my trailer that probably wasn't too smart. But I'm like, oh, here we go.
Embrace the Suck. It's part three of Cheap Dirt. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Around this time last year, we heard about a special food sovereignty project on the Wind River Reservation, including traditional foods like chokecherry jam and bison meat in the Food Bank of Wyoming's monthly distributions in honor of Native American Heritage Month. This year, 700 boxes of food went out into the community at the end of November, each with a package of bison meat from the reservation. Elders also got a jar of chokecherry jam as a special gift. And because this season's seen a spike in food insecurity, it was the second distribution of the month. Normally, there's just one. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman takes us behind the scenes of Distribution Day.
It's a chilly Monday morning, and a handful of people are tossing packages of bison meat from the back of a pickup truck into a wheeled cart.
We're going to start counting out 300.
That's Northern Arapaho tribal member Jackie White. The meat's wrapped in white butcher paper and got picked up even earlier this morning from the Wind River Tribal Buffalo Initiative.
Katie, we're getting closer.
White is the tribal relations specialist for the Food Bank of Wyoming. The group is dropping off the bison at the Eastern Shoshone Tribal Health Building in Fort Washakie, one of two spots for the food distributions today.
95, 100. Okay, somebody take that and put that in there.
As the sorting continues, a volunteer with the Wyoming Children's Trust Fund takes a cardboard box into the storage room.
This is the chokecherry jam and then the letters that the kids wrote.
The letters are from local schools, and the dark purple jam is made from chokecherries picked in Longmont, Colorado, the homelands of the Arapaho people.
Oh, they look beautiful. Wow.
Then the crew zooms over to the second distribution spot to drop off the other half of the goods. Next stop, the Arapaho School. A forklift grabs pallets stacked with cardboard boxes from a big truck in the parking lot. They're rolled into the gym and set up in long lines filled with staples like beans and rice. But now it's time for the fresh stuff. Enter more local volunteers and high school students. It's all hands on deck. One team sorts produce into bags,
apples, potatoes,
and then others go down the line of boxes, putting in the produce and the bison meat.
Putting meat in the boxes one by one.
Amidst all the action, I even get interviewed by a couple curious high schoolers.
I'm going to ask you to state your name and occupation.
Okay, my name is Hannah Haberman, and I am a journalist with Wyoming Public Radio.
Awesome.
Little Raven Oldman works at the school and says the students know the drill.
They've been doing this quite a long time, and it's really awesome to see them like just jump right in and get the job done.
Originally, a different grade would help out each month. But now?
It's just a mixture of, I think they enjoy coming here to do this, so they're like, I'll go.
Kids can also grab boxes to take home to their family, and some do. Old Man says the best part is watching the kids work together as a team.
I know we're all struggling, you know, in our own way, but this really helps out a lot because food brings people together, and that's what it's about, family and community.
After all the boxes are filled up, it's time to get them to the long line of cars wrapped around the school building.
Yeah, it says two on the blue truck.
I've got two more bags of carrots.
No.
You guys want to break boxes?
Just pairs.
As we toss them, that'd be awesome. Thank you.
Nayeli Hernandez is outside helping load boxes into cars.
especially during like the government shutdown. I was like, this is needed, especially in Wyoming and rural places.
She's getting her social work degree at the University of Wyoming.
Food security is a big like protective factor in like specifically child abuse, but honestly in like all issues, and just like general welfare for like the community is really important for social work.
Jackie White is catching her breath after making sure the bison meat and chokecherries got into the boxes. She says they've run out of food at the last couple distributions. And it's not just folks from Wind River.
We have people come from Lander, Riverton, Kinnear, Pavilion, Shoshone, and we don't turn anybody away. As long as we have food and they're in line, they're going to get food.
Some of the elder boxes will get hand-delivered to those who can't drive or don't have a car. White says the chokecherry jam is a small gesture, but it can have a big impact.
We want them to know that we love them, we value them, and that our elders are significant to us because they're our knowledge keepers.
She says the high school students helping out today are her heroes.
That's the goal, to teach our kids about giving back into the community, but they're stepping up to be leaders, and I love that.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Wayne B. Hughes Jr. and his wife, Molly, have embedded themselves in Wyoming's social and political fabric since moving from California to Jackson Hole about 8 years ago. That's because they've become a few of the state's top donors in philanthropy and politics. Recently, Wildfile collaborated with Jackson Hole News and Guide and Jackson Hole Community Radio to examine the family's influence. I spoke with Sophia Boyd Flegel from Jackson Hole Community Radio to hear about their findings. Let's start with, who are the Hughes?
Wayne B. Hughes Jr. and Molly moved from California. Wayne is an heir to a fortune from a self-storage company founded by his father. And back in his 30s, he started donating to philanthropic and political causes and has really boosted his giving as he's gotten older. He's in his 60s now. And Wayne and Molly have become a critical part of Wyoming's civic backbone.
How's that?
Well, they're big givers to Jackson's affordable housing scene, and they've given millions more across the state to providers for so many causes, including domestic violence survivors, those recovering from addiction, and food for the hungry. We looked at FCC filings to see how they've also become some of the biggest donors in Wyoming's politics. And a quick note, we had help researching all of the Hughes' giving from the Sunlight Research Center.
So what's motivating all this giving?
Politically, they're Republicans, though Wayne Jr. has donated to Democratic PACs too. But more than politics, the first thing you should know is that the Hughes are predominantly motivated by their Christian faith. Wayne previously told a Forbes reporter he became more serious about philanthropy after finding his Christian faith in his late 30s and becoming jaded after a stint of seeking change through Washington politics. That came up a lot in my reporting on the Hughes Charitable Foundation. Their literature shows they want to make life easier for people who are caught in what they call the impact zone. That's a term Wayne borrows from surfing. It's the area between the wave breaks and the shore that's really hard to swim out of either way. The Hughes didn't talk to us for this story, but Wayne's described it as how a lot of Americans are living right now, paycheck to paycheck, or trapped in domestic violence, or addiction, or hunger. And that's their charitable foundation's goal demographic.
Got it. And have they been successful with that?
We use public filings and announcements to piece together that since entering the state, the foundation has given or pledged what we estimate to be $75 million to over 300 Wyoming nonprofits. Requests to the foundation to confirm that figure went unanswered.
Well, that seems like a lot. How does that rank with other foundations in the state?
That's a harder question to answer. But Samin Dadalehi, who runs the Wyoming Community Foundation, said that of all institutional philanthropy in the state in recent years, the Hughes' giving has been about 10%. And she said that's a big slice for one family. She was one of several people who pointed out that the Hughes didn't come into Wyoming to start their own thing. They've supported the nonprofits that are already here.
So how does this idea of the impact zone and living by their Christian faith play out in how they donate?
Well, by dollar figure, they've given or pledged the most to affordable housing, over $25 million in just Jackson Hole. Also, Indigenous affairs like relocating the American Indian Village at Cheyenne Frontier Days and services for youth in the criminal justice system. They've made headlines recently for a gift of $500,000 to Wyoming PBS. And they really support hunger initiatives in the state, too. And by putting $1 million every year into WIO Gives, they are spreading their money all around the state.
And just a quick disclosure that Wyoming Public Media and WIOfile were media partners this year participating in the matching portion of WIO Gives. So how competitive are these dollars?
The grants are by invite only, but I talked to one of their board members who couldn't really remember a time in 3 years that they had turned someone down. Dot Alahi with the Wyoming Community Foundation put it this way.
In some ways, they have a really traditional lens when it comes to charity, in that they are focusing on those bottom line safety net services.
How have these priorities played out in the Hughes political giving?
It's changed over time. For example, a decade ago in California, Wayne spent really big to help get a ballot initiative passed. It reduced prison sentences for minor crimes and drug offenses, and this was a bipartisan issue. He also donated to two Democratic PACs before 2008. His spending was issue-focused. Since moving to Wyoming, Wayne has broadly backed Republicans. He gave to Trump and candidates closely aligned with Trump, like Ted Cruz and Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem when she was running for governor of South Dakota.
What about any Wyoming candidates?
He backed Liz Cheney before she condemned Trump, following the January 6th Capitol riots. And then he gave to Harriet Hegman, whose votes tend to align with the U.S. Freedom Caucus. Within the state, the bulk of Wayne's giving has been to moderate candidates. We interviewed Senator Ogden Driscoll, a moderate from Devil's Tower. Wayne donated $1,500 to his campaign in 2022, money Driscoll says he didn't ask for. He said that they seem to be trying to support what has been in Wyoming in the past. Wayne has even been subject to some criticism from some on the far right, including posts from Honor Wyoming. It's a political group founded in 2023 that has supported staunchly conservative politicians aligned with the Wyoming Freedom Caucus.
Sophia, there's quite a bit more we could get into, but I just encourage people to check out the full article online.
Yeah, seeing where the money goes is a lot easier with the nice charts we made.
Yeah, thanks for sharing your reporting.
Thank you.
Data centers are popping up across the Mountain West to power AI. The U.S. Interior Secretary says it's not only electricity that they need. Up next on Open Spaces, what Western governors are saying about the AI boom.
Hi, I'm Grady Kirkpatrick, inviting you to join me for Wyoming Sounds. Along with your favorites, you'll discover plenty of new music. We bring you NPR news updates, weather, and we'll let you know about events happening around Wyoming. Wyoming Sounds from 9 to noon on Wyoming Public Radio and 24/7 online at wyomingsounds.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio. I'm Nikki Willett.
And I'm Camila Godalska. Wyoming and other states across the western U.S. are trying to figure out how to bring enough energy online to serve their growing populations and the explosive growth of AI data centers. The topic dominated the Western Governors Association winter meeting in Arizona last month. Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon was not in attendance. Wayne Schutzke reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
It didn't take long for Utah Governor Spencer Cox to bring up energy as he delivered his opening speech at the meeting.
We knew that the need for electricity was going to increase across our country, but we just didn't realize the scale, the scope, and the speed at which we would need it.
Cox, who chairs the Western Governors Association, said that energy is both a matter of national security and affordability for everyday Americans.
We need to be able to move the energy, those electrons, from one place to another in a way that makes sure that it's secure and that we can reduce the cost to our citizens who are struggling right now.
Interior Secretary Doug Burgum delivered a similar message during his keynote speech.
How do we make sure that we've got the power that we need to win the AI arms race against China?
Cox called for permitting reform, especially in western states where it can sometimes take a decade or more to build major transmission projects that crisscross federal and state lines.
In states like Utah, where the federal government owns about two-thirds of the land in our state, it's not just about energy production, although much of that production has to take place on federal lands, which we don't control, so we need help there. It's also about transmission.
Burgum said the Trump administration is already taking steps on its own to speed up some energy projects. He claimed his team was able to complete an environmental review that usually takes years in under a month. Efforts critics and environmental groups have argued sidestep important steps in the process and may even violate the law.
I would put a 24-day EIS up against a stack of ones that took 2 years and ask any of you or ask any judge to say which one was the one that took 24 days.
Burgum acknowledged the department will have to work with Congress to accomplish more of the administration's permitting reform goals, some of which could find some bipartisan support. Arizona Democratic Senator Ruben Gallego has backed permitting reform before and told the U.S. Hispanic Business Council it is needed to meet the country's energy needs.
So we need to have a very agnostic position when it comes to energy, which means all forms of energy as fast as possible on the grid.
At last week's conference, Cox, the Utah Republican, expressed a similar sentiment, saying the country needs to adopt an all-of-the-above approach to meeting its energy needs.
We all know that we need more of everything right now, and we've got to figure out how to do that.
So far, the Trump administration has not taken that approach, aggressively backing coal and gas production while curtailing major renewable projects on federal land. And those reforms Burgum spoke of, they did not apply to solar or wind projects. Just hours after Cox made his comments, Burgum said,
so we're in a world there is no energy transition. Newsflash.
Burgum offered a criticism often levied by opponents of renewable energy.
We were heading towards a world where every light switch would have to have a sign that may or may not work based on whether the wind is blowing or the sun is shining.
Renewable advocates discount that criticism, saying advancements in battery storage technology have made it more reliable, regardless of time of day or weather. But Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs and Hawaii Governor Josh Green, both Democrats who have backed efforts to boost renewable energy production, didn't push back on Burgum's comments. For his part, Cox offered a couched disagreement, saying he agrees with the Trump administration's decision to cancel some renewable projects.
Some of the wind projects I think just don't pencil out, that we've spent a lot of money on in the past, money that could have been spent somewhere else. And so solar with batteries, though, is different than just plain solar. So baseload matters, and we desperately need more baseload.
At the meeting, Burgum, the former governor of North Dakota, reminded the panel that electricity generation isn't the only problem posed by the AI revolution.
We need water for these data centers as well, for cooling, or you can build your data centers in North Dakota because then you don't need as much cooling. It's just...
The Western governors agreed with that assessment, but gave no indication at the meeting that they are close to resolving the ongoing water stalemate between upper and lower basin states over Colorado River water. Wayne Schutzke, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Adapting to the reality of climate change means rethinking jobs, especially the skilled trades. Ray Solomon reports for the Mountain West News Bureau from Colorado's High Country, where a new program is teaching workers to flip the switch for an energy-efficient future.
We all know the mountain towns of Colorado are slices of paradise, but apparently even heaven has its industrial zones. In the town of Eagle, that's where you'll find the headquarters of R&H Mechanical, a building systems contractor.
Step it back down to a usable voltage.
Josh McCarl stands in front of a classroom here, lecturing students on the basics of electricity.
So AC stands for, anybody?
Alternating current.
Alternating current, DC stands for?
Direct current.
McCarl is laying the groundwork for these students to become HVAC technicians and work with heat pump technology, super energy efficient heating and cooling systems powered by electricity.
Flow of an electric current through a conductor produces a magnetic field around the conductor.
This class is among the first of its kind anywhere in the high country. It's part of a massive push by Colorado Mountain College to expand local training in the skilled trades.
Here in the mountains, it's been challenging to find new talent, so we have to grow our own.
That's Tim Braun with R&H Mechanical. He says his company is so hungry for skilled workers, they partnered with the college to build this program. The graduates earn nationally recognized credentials. Braun says there's a big demand for these workers who can help transition from gas-burning heating and cooling systems to heat pumps.
There's been a big gap in our workforce development that we need to pick up more talent to be able to help with that transition in the future.
There are wait lists to get into these skilled trades classes, and the college wants to more than double capacity.
When I started, I really knew nothing about heating and air conditioning.
Andrea Anderson is one of the students here. She works as a quotes administrator for R&H and is taking this class to get better at her job.
And over the years, I've learned a lot, but now I just want to learn some more.
Anderson and her classmates aren't just earning credentials and building their careers. Megan Christensen with the Colorado Energy Office says they're part of the state's big picture plan to combat climate change, which includes climate workforce development.
In almost every single energy and climate action that our state has, the skilled trades are super, super essential to making sure that work gets done.
And they're super essential in rural areas particularly. State data shows the shortage is even more severe in remote regions where exposure to climate change is greatest.
It's an issue that is impacting all parts of life and their economies.
Elizabeth Harbaugh is with LIRA Colorado, a Northwest Colorado nonprofit in the education and climate space.
We work with ranchers up in Northwest Colorado who can speak very openly about the lack of water and how that's changed their outputs over the past, 10 years. And then when you talk about recreation, snowpack is a huge issue.
Rural communities revolve around agriculture and outdoor recreation. Natural resources threatened by climate warming don't just power rural economies, they define the region's culture and identity. Harbaugh says that's why these communities need to be engaged in climate solutions, like training HVAC techs to work with energy-efficient heat pumps. She says we need to start preparing young people here for that future now.
When we look at resilience in rural regions, we need to be thinking about not only environmental sustainability, but what does it look like to be socially sustainable, economically sustainable, and environmentally sustainable.
Expanding workforce training and the well-paying skilled trades checks all those boxes at once. In Eagle, Colorado, I'm Ray Solomon, KUNC.
A 28-song posthumous album by Luke Bell is out. Up next, we hear from his aunt about their relationship and the importance of mental health. This is Open Spaces.
It can be hard to keep track of the news, but Wyoming Public Radio just made it a little easier. Now you can follow us on Apple News to get the latest stories from Wyoming right in the palm of your hand. Plus, you can get an audio roundup of daily local news in under 10 minutes with our new podcast. Check out Wyoming Debrief, a morning habit that pairs perfectly with your cup of coffee.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Rolling Stone said country singer Luke Bell of Cody was poised to be the next big thing. He had opened for famed artists like Dwight Yoakam and Willie Nelson and garnered a growing fan base drawn to his traditional country sound. But his rise was cut short when the 32-year-old died from a fentanyl overdose in Arizona in 2022 after a struggle with mental illness. The King is Back, a 28-song posthumous album, came out in early November. Sarah Flitner, Luke's aunt, recently sat down with Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Fulpula-Inkney to talk about her relationship with her nephew and how his death has bolstered her work's purpose. Flitner, also Jackson's former mayor, founded Becoming Jackson Hole, a nonprofit supporting mental health.
I wonder if you could describe Luke's music.
Oh my gosh, I think that's impossible. You have to listen to it, right? But I just think of him as a meteor on stage. You know, it just explosions and energy and, you know, he's got the harmonica around his neck. He's playing like crazy on the guitar. He's singing. There's sweat flying. He had so much energy and joy and passion.
I wonder if you could describe your relationship with Luke Bell.
Well, I was his favorite aunt, of course. My relationship with Luke was just special. Luke was the firstborn grandson. He was my first nephew. And he was just such an adventuresome, stubborn, willful, creative kid, just so unique. We were so surprised when he died because we didn't expect so much attention. We had no idea that Luke had made such impact on so many people around him. I think what I loved about Luke and the way that I got to experience Luke and spend time with him is exactly the reason that he resonates so much still now with his music. He was a tender, caring, passionate, talented musician and person. He really, really cared about, as trite as it might sound, about his fellow man, woman. You know, he really cared about people, and that showed.
You mentioned the impact that his music had on so many people. I wonder if you could tell me more about that.
Luke was authentic. Luke truly cared and saw the humanity in people. And I know that's why. There are things that I can't explain, like some of the lyrics at levels that just don't match, you know, his age at the time that he was writing about the working man's blues and even, you know, experiences that he just hadn't had necessarily. But he could just see right from heart to heart. You know, Luke lived through that ability to perceive a person and to see the dignity, the inherent dignity in every single human being. And for whatever reason, he was always attracted to kind of the less accepted, the less shiny and presentable. He had a real soft spot for the down and out or the people who were looking at life through, you know, a tougher circumstance. And I love that. I love that he cared so deeply, and it wasn't an act. It wasn't put on.
You've started this nonprofit. It's called Becoming Jackson Hole, focusing on mindfulness. I wonder if your work has any influence from Luke.
Of course it does. It was an idea that I had before Luke got sick. But ironically, you know, Luke was literally the only young person in my life at the time who was interested in mindfulness or meditation. And he always wanted to know what kind of meditation I was most interested in. And so there was that fun connection, interesting connection, but it didn't... It wasn't until much later when Luke began to taste success, and he was still early 20s, managing a band of 5 people and traveling all over in a broken down van, when he would ask, when we would see each other, you know, could we do a practice, and what kind of meditation would you recommend for these kinds of circumstances, and do you have any advice, and how do I keep it going? It's so hectic. So I cherish those memories because it felt like he was getting some of his mental health needs met, and they were like on the continuum like you and I would have. It wasn't, of course, until later that I would realize the kind of work that I do at Becoming Jackson Hole was in no way going to touch what Luke was struggling with.
Yeah. Sarah, I wonder what you hope for going forward.
What I hope, and what my sister hopes, what our whole family hopes, is that our culturally and in society and in community, that we begin to understand that mental health, like physical health, is always on a continuum. And there are things that we can do to protect our physical health and our mental health. And of course, mindfulness and focused attention, you know, training is one of those things. Seeking mental health providers when you need a sounding board or are struggling with something. Certainly seeking deeper care if you are on the continuum where Luke found himself after a psychotic break. What we hope is that, A, people learn about the things that they can do to protect themselves when possible, and B, that they learn it's not always possible to protect yourself. You know, just like if I break my leg, I need the help of a physician to set that bone and perhaps do surgery. I can't just heal it by myself. There's no shame in that. No one judges me for going to the doctor to help my body stay healthy. As far as we may have come, we have so much farther to go in terms of understanding what mental illness really is and how it affects the brain. I want people to feel the compassion that I think Luke felt for people in general.
Yeah. Why do you think the title is The King is Back?
I think it was an anthem. I think it was a prayer. Honestly, he wrote that when he was, you know, beginning to suffer from mental illness he began to play it more. And I think he's starting to realize and that things are not going the way you might hope. And his music was part of his therapy, I guess, you know, part of his way of like a mantra, you know, I'm back, party's on. That's how I think of it.
That was Luke Bell's aunt, Sarah Flitner, talking about her nephew's posthumous album with Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Fulpula Inkney. All proceeds from the album's sale will go to the Luke Bell Memorial Affordable Counseling Program, a nonprofit started by his family to provide counseling in Northwest Wyoming.
I'm sure you've all been dying to see me. I bet you've all been wondering where I'm at. I heard things just ain't the same without me. Hold your hats, the party's on, the king is back. Slumming in the hard parts of the city. I've been gnawing on the bones to find some fat. I've been poor and I've been angry, I can guarantee you that. Hold your hats, the party's on, the king is back.
Shorter days means more nighttime driving, and across the Mountain West, that leads to more collisions with animals. States, including Wyoming, have built wildlife overpasses and underpasses to decrease the number of collisions, and it's worked. So much so that states have invested millions of dollars to build more of them. The Mountain West News Bureau's Stephanie Daniel takes us to a stretch of highway just south of Laramie, where a new crossing is making a difference.
Highway 287 is a busy thoroughfare. In North Larimer County, it winds through rural communities and wildlife habitat.
You could say that Highway 287 was kind of a ribbon of death for wildlife because they all have to cross it on their traditional east-west seasonal movements.
Rick Knight is a professor at Colorado State University who lives in this area. Standing in the Stonewall Creek bed, which runs underneath the highway, he explains why 287 was dangerous in this spot.
There used to be a big old wicked five-strand barbed wire fence here.
Ranchers who own the land on either side of the highway would open this barbed wire fence only for their cattle to pass through. Otherwise, it was closed. So wildlife had to cross on the highway above. Stonewall Creek is part of a 30-mile stretch of the highway in North Larimer County that can be treacherous for animals and motorists. Over a four-year period ending in 2024, more than 300 vehicles crashed along this part of the highway. A third were caused by wildlife, primarily deer. None were fatal for humans, but lots of animals were killed. Knight and a few others came up with an idea to help wildlife cross safely.
This is a typical wildlife-friendly crossing. It's beneath the highway. It has a gate so the landowners can still move their cows on either side of their pastures.
Knight got permission from local ranchers to take down the barbed wire fence and put up this wildlife-friendly crossing. Situated under the highway, it's simple. Next to the gate are wooden posts that allow deer, pronghorn, elk, and other wild animals to pass through.
All they're doing is making motorists a lot safer because wildlife have an alternative.
Wildlife fencing and overpass projects are happening across Colorado, funded by state and federal dollars. These are big construction projects that can take many months to build. But crossings like this one in Stonewall Creek are much smaller. Each costs about $500 and takes a day to build.
We tried it out with a volunteer day with students.
That's Front Range Community College faculty member Heather Danahauer. She partnered with Knight on this project. They asked students from both of their schools to help out.
They loved it. We loved it. It seemed to be successful, and so it's just kind of grown from there.
Since 2021, CSU and FRCC students have built four wildlife-friendly crossings under 287. Danahauer says they've studied the impacts roads and fences can have on wildlife habitat.
Getting them out on the landscape to actually see the barriers, to actually be a part of a solution, I think that's far more impactful.
The team has partnered on this project with state agencies like the Colorado Department of Transportation. They hope to build more crossings, but for now, students can monitor the wildlife and collect data thanks to cameras installed at each location. Back at the Stonewall Creek Wildlife Crossing underneath Highway 287.
I have a little binder. I just kind of keep basic camera notes. I give all the cameras names.
Rick Knight's colleague Annie Hoffman is swapping out SD cards and batteries on two cameras.
I'm going to put these back over there and then do the next one.
Hoffman helped build this crossing in 2024 when she was a student at FRCC. Now she works at CDOT. Part of her job is to manage the images taken by the cameras. So far, she's cataloged close to 1 million photos of wildlife.
You can see how much use it's getting, and wildlife aren't getting hit because they're using a safer structure.
CDOT is using this data to help inform future strategies to prevent collisions between wildlife and drivers on Highway 287. Because, as the images show, animals are now finding another way to cross the road. In Larimer County, Stephanie Daniel, KUNC.
Wyoming recently broke ground on a wildlife crossing project south of Kemmer.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. They can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all of our stories on the station's social media platforms, including Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, X, and Big Sky.
And a huge thanks to Hannah Haberman, this episode's audio producer, Jacob Hoffman, our digital producer, and Cody Hume, our social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.